Finding great candidates to hire can be like, well, trying to find a needle in a haystack. Sure, you can post your job to some job board, but then all you can do is hope the right person comes along. Which is why you should try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its powerful technology identifies people with the right experience and actively invites them to apply to your job. You get qualified candidates fast. So while other companies might deliver a lot of hay, ZipRecruiter finds you what you're looking for. The needle in the haystack.
See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free, at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. That's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
There is a time for some things and a time for all things. A time for great things and a time for small things. Miguel de Cervantes. Welcome to this week's episode of Warfare, Advancement, and Revisionism. My name is Preston Floyd, and as always, I'm your host. I'd like to thank you all for joining me this week. I appreciate your support. Please like, rate, download, subscribe, all that kind of good stuff. If you're a newcomer, again, welcome. I hope you will enjoy and will avail yourself of our backlog of episodes. And if you're a returning listener, thank you, as always, for your continued support. It really does mean a lot. So this week's episode, we will be focusing on a couple of Neolithic cultures as they develop and possibly disappear along the lower Yangtze Delta and the Yangtze River and its delta, kind of between the years of 6 and 4000 BC, BCE, whichever you prefer. Before that, though, I did want to go over one thing that I forgot to mention in last week's episode, and that concerns the Pengtoshan site of Ba Shidong. I mentioned domesticated rice had been found there, but I did forget to include that though these were domesticated, or at least semi-domesticated strains, they weren't related to either Oryza sativa japonica or Oryza sativa indica. So, for some reason, these strains were lost or abandoned by later peoples. Remember, as always, domestication is not a straightforward process. For some reason or other, some strains just aren't as popular or just get replaced by more strains conducive to their environment or that are maybe more productive in certain places. So people may begin to kind of switch them out as time goes on. Another thing I did want to just remind everyone this, and as you probably are realizing as you're listening to this, this episode's being posted a little bit later. It's being recorded at the same time, but due to some advice I had gotten from some people saying, hey, you might want to let your episodes rest a little longer, like in the process of them being published, because different services, the longer you leave them to rest, the algorithm has a better job of kind of sorting it into pushing it out to new people trying to discover them. So I am going to be doing that. I'm also thinking about maybe doing a small bit of editing for the YouTube side of things, maybe adding some still images. I'm going to try to have some of that done this week. It's not going to be like a full video. Again, it's just going to be pictures. I don't want to spend too much time on that because I do kind of want to keep, you know, a little. Yeah, I don't want people to like feel like they have to watch it on YouTube. I want to kind of make sure that you're getting kind of a full picture from the audio. But I am thinking about doing that because that is something that I was told might help a little bit on the YouTube side of things. But that's all stuff for me to worry about. If you're, you know, just an audio listener, you're not going to be missing much. I can guarantee it, at least for the first few seasons I'm going to be trying this. So, with all that out of the way, let's jump into this episode's focus. Now, at the start of our season, the region where the Yangtze River and its tributaries enter the sea, we have no evidence of any single dominant Neolithic culture of either hunter-gatherers or agriculturalists. Now, that's not to say there weren't any small permanent settlements that practiced a mix of hunting, gathering, fishing, domesticated herding, and pseudo-agriculture. It's just these sites, if and where they existed, were very small both in terms of size and population. And they weren't doing anything new in terms of tools, art, construction, food production, etc. At least from what we've discovered so far. However, around 6000 BCE, give or take a century or two one way or the other, in what is now the Jiaoshan district of the city of Hangzhou, on a small island on the Zhanghu Lake, a site was established that today is known as the Guahuqiao Yiji, or just the Guahuqiao. The name of the site translates is something like across the bridge site. Qua meaning across, hu meaning lake, and chao is a bridge. Now, this site was actually first uncovered in the early 1970s when construction of a nearby brick factory destroyed a small portion of the site. However, it wasn't fully excavated until the 1990s. I don't know why, but based on when it was discovered, I'm assuming it was related to the Cultural Revolution's rather dim view of the past. And then, of course, the fallout of the end of the Cultural Revolution probably, you know, caused problems as well. But since the original excavation, there have been a couple of other, you know, studies and excavations done on the site with, of course, additional studies done on the various finds themselves. Now, what makes Guahuqiao interesting is that the scholars who have studied it believe that the people living there were unconnected to the other singular Neolithic villages or sites in the area that preceded them, or, you know, maybe existed around the same time period. And that is that their pottery is much more sophisticated in terms of how consistent and well-made it is, as well as the variety of shapes and sizes of their vessels. This has led to the theory that the people at Guahuqiao were using wheels and things like that to help shape and create their pottery. They were also producing canoes, and this is probably the most important find at Guahuqiao. Now, we, of course, had long suspected Neolithic man and earlier peoples of being able to produce simple boats like this. And, you know, old ones had been found before, but the one dugout canoe found here was much older than what had been found prior. A couple of different labs had performed carbon dating on it, and they dated it to having been created sometime between 6200 and 5600 BC. The mud and climate of this region is very helpful in preserving artifacts, wooden artifacts specifically, in this region, and that kind of helped conserve the canoe. And for a while, it was the oldest one that had been found. Now, since then, some canoes that were close to its age have been discovered. One was found in Nigeria, and that dates to around the same time. It might be a little younger if the later dates are correct for the Guahuqiao vessels, but if the older ones are right, then it was made a couple of centuries prior. Also, I think one has been found in the Netherlands or Germany that dates to around 8000 BC. If it wasn't the Netherlands, it was Germany. If it was Germany, or if it wasn't Germany, it was the Netherlands. But then whichever country the one made at 8000 BC, let me think of a better way to phrase this. So, I think it was the Netherlands. That one dates to around 8000 BC. And then you found a couple of in Germany that are a little bit younger than the Guahuqiao, but they're within a couple of centuries of that one. And if I did get the countries wrong, just transverse them, and it's the opposite's the case. But I believe it was the Netherlands. Now, the one made at Guahuqiao was made of pine. And, of course, it while it's very reasonably well preserved, it isn't perfectly preserved. So we don't know its full length. The portion we have is about 560 centimeters long, which translates to about 18 feet. And we know that its width was between 52 centimeters, which is around 1.7 feet. And the width, we know for sure how wide it was. We don't know how thick it was. The amount of thickness that remains is about 2.5 centimeters, which is like almost an inch. And the remaining depth of the hull is around 15 centimeters, which is like 6 inches. But burn marks show that they used a very widespread method of creating dugout canoes. Essentially, they used fire to kind of hollow out the logs, and then they used the fire to help shape them, and they used probably stone adzes to kind of chip away portions that had that they had used the fire to burn out. And this is, again, very, very common method for creating canoes. And it's used all over the world. But it seems from remaining buildings and kind of structures found at the site that Quahuchao was a place primarily used to construct or repair canoes. Despite their well-made pottery, it doesn't look like the pottery was actually produced at the site. Instead, it was made at a smaller site around 2 to 2.5 kilometers away, which is like a mile to like a mile and a half away. But both sites had homes, and the homes were constructed in the same way. They were made of wood. They were elevated on kind of earthen mounds above kind of the marshy ground. And some even had ladders that had been discovered around there that you know made them easier to access. And this type of housing is not unique to Quahuchao. Most people living in the marshes in this part of the world use this type of housing. So, you know, this is probably a very long-lasting and very widespread way to build houses, even before, you know, probably this period. They also grew some of their own food. I should point out they do think that the Quahuchao, apparently the woodwork was better. They used types of joints for some of their structures that you don't really see. I forget the term. I meant to write it down, but I did not include it. But that probably wouldn't be too much of a surprise if they're really making a lot of canoes. They're probably much better at woodwork specifically. But that, again, that's just me kind of guessing from kind of reading the sources. It's a little bit debated about that, but we'll get into that a little bit more in a bit. But in addition to growing domesticated rice, they grew a domesticated strain that shares similarities to both Indica and Japonica rice. So it's a strain of Oryza sativa before the split of those two species happened. However, they were not pure agriculturalists. They also foraged wild fruits and plants as well. They may have also been keeping domesticated pigs, though this is debated, and even if they did keep domesticated pigs, they were also hunting and killing a lot of different types of wild animals. They have found over 5,000 bones of various types of animals, and this includes, you know, things that we might consider rather mundane, like deer, waterfowl, and things, and of course wild pigs too, which is part of the reason the domesticated pig angle is kind of debated, because again, early domesticated breeds, they don't differ that much physically from wild breeds. But in addition to the, you know, again, the more things we would probably consider mundane, they've also found the bones of things like tigers and rhinos. Now, there are three types of Asian rhinos that are alive today. These are the Indian, the Sumatran, and the Javan rhinos. I don't know which variety. It did not say in the sources of rhinos they found there, but they were probably Sumatran or Javan. I don't think the Indian rhinos crossed, kind of crossed that land barrier. We know, I think, later art from the area shows what I think usually is Sumatran, but then there are also some art of things that could easily be Javan rhinos. I think the difference is the size and number of horns. At Quahuchao, it was occupied for around 500 years or so, maybe a little longer. But around 6,000 BC, the water level is very similar to what it is today. But for around 500 years, between 5,500 and 5,000 BC, the area saw a large amount of flooding, and the site was abandoned during that period. After that, no successor site to the Quahuchao people has been found. The sites of other Yangtze Delta Neolithic peoples are not believed by most scholars to be related to them. And the only reason I could find, said in some of the articles I read were that they were not as technologically advanced as the Quahuchao. What that means exactly, I couldn't find spelled out. But I believe it is related, again, to their part of their home design. They weren't quite as large. Their wood was less well-shaped. They didn't work it quite as finely. But also their pottery. Their pottery was much rougher. Though in some cases, it was a little bit more decorated. But that usually comes from a later period, kind of towards the end of some of these cultures, which we're going to now move into. And the first of these cultures we're going to talk about is the Himudu. Now, I couldn't quite nail down a firm translation of this name, but it's something like the Governess River Fairy, which Governess is Mu, River is He, and the fairy is Du. And this culture existed along the southern bank of the Hangzhou Bay, which is about 50 miles, 75 kilometers west of the small island that the Quahuchao lived on. Now, these people were much more reliant on agriculture, and they had, fairly sizable rice fields irrigated by the nearby rivers, and they would be irrigated by floods and tides and things like that. Now, of course, they still hunted and fished. Carp was a very big part of their diet, and probably provided most of their protein. They also possibly kept pigs, though again, that's debated. It's possible they were just hunting wild boar and things like that. They also had dogs, which I can't remember if I mentioned it, but the Quahuchao had dogs as well. Now, one of the reasons, again, that they're not thought to be a direct descendant of the Quahuchao is that their pottery was roughly made. It was very thick, but it was also very porous. And one thing they did do, however, that is definitely something that you don't see at the Quahuchao sites, is that they would mix charcoal powder in with their pottery, and it gives it a really striking dark black color. And some of the designs that they would carve into them would, they're done, and it shows as a white kind of figure painting, or not painting, but like a white carving in this very dark black pottery. So it makes them very stark and stands out. They also didn't have quite as much variety in the size and shapes of their vessels. Another thing that they had that was different from the Quahuchao is that they were also creating lacquered wood items. They also had access to jade, and they had ivory, like the Quahuchao did, but they would actually carve these jade items as well as the ivory items. And the ivory items especially, some of those designs get very, very intricate. And all of these artistic pieces are depiction of animals, like pigs, deers, birds. And some of them are so sophisticated, at least when it comes to the birds, that they're thought to be depictions of early depictions of one of the big figures in Chinese mythology and religion is the phoenix. Though, again, some of that's debated. Some people are like, it's not a phoenix, it's just a really, really brightly, or more like a jungle fowl, or perhaps a peacock of some kind. Another kind of artifact that the Himmudu are associated with are reed mats. Now, these aren't really unique. They're made all over the place, but the Himmudu appear to have made a lot of them. And they would use them to kind of decorate and, cover their homes. And they lived in larger communal dwellings than the Kwahuchiao did. And they were, again, stilted houses, built up over earthen platforms elevated above kind of the marshy land. So while they may not have had as much technical skill as the Kwahuchiao, I think their artistic sense is much more appealing. Though, again, art is, of course, subjective, and that's just my opinion. Now, the Himmudu sites will continue to be occupied until next season, and carry on more or less as they have since they emerged this season around 5,500 BC, at least materially. Culturally, there is a debate, and I couldn't find the sourcing on this, so I'm a little hesitant to include it, but I'll at least mention it. And I would advise you to take this next section with a little bit of a grain of salt like I have. But on Wikipedia, there is a theory that initially the Himmudu were a matrilineal culture. And as time went on and the sites got larger, they shifted to a more patriarchal society. Again, the source for that isn't really mentioned, so it could have been removed or no longer considered relevant. But that is not really an unusual theory. There are a lot of ideas about more balanced, egalitarian, early agricultural societies slowly being supplanted by male-dominated ones. And we've talked about that before. We'll talk about it again. But I haven't seen any evidence of that in any of the articles I've read. That's more of an anthropological discussion than an archaeological one. And without any history sources at this period, it's no reason to really dive into it on the history end either, but I did want to just put that theory out there because it is something that has been mentioned. Now, there is one other culture that develops around the same time as the Himmudu. Maybe a little bit later, the Himmudu emerges around, again, 5,500. This one emerges right around 5,000, again, give or take 100 years. And that is the Majiabang culture. Now, the name translates to something like the horse home coast. And I should point this out in case it isn't clear, but all these names that we've been talking about are from more modern place names. But Ma is horse, home is Jia, and Bang is, it's a little bit harder to translate, but it could mean shore, it could mean coast, it could just mean like stream or something along those lines. But Bang is the harder character to kind of nail down. Now, some scholars believe that the Himmudu and the Majiabang are the same people. Others believe that they were just two closer cultures that were relatively close, and they had a lot of contact and influenced each other, in various ways. The Majiabang sites were on the northern shores of the Hangzhou Bay, so they had the Hangzhou Bay separating them. And they were up to around the banks of Lake Tai, which is about, on average, about 85 miles, 140 kilometers to the north of the Himmudu sites. And in earlier periods, the Majiabang were actually thought to be offshoots connected to Neolithic sites and cultures farther north. And people thought, well, these people in the along the Yellow River, a little bit more advanced, they probably traveled down either along the coast and then occupied the Yangtze Delta and then moved upriver from there. That theory has been abandoned. It has been for a while. But we will be talking about some of the cultures that people initially associated the Majia Bang with. Now, personally, I think the Himadu and Majia Bang were separate cultures. And firstly, my primary reason for this is that the Himadu appear around 5,500 BC. And I'm not quite sure why, you know, the Majia Bang get pride of place in the naming. It might be because they were discovered first. But I can't say that for sure. But again, the Himadu appear around 5,500, which is around 500 years before the Majia Bang appear. Now, that's not to say they don't share certain similarities. They certainly shared a reliance on rice and fish, though it does seem like the Majia Bang had it more access to, or at least like to throw in more things like deer and more land-based protein into their diet. They definitely had domesticated pigs and dogs, or at least that's what the literature says. They're very confident that they have domesticated pigs, whereas the Himadu sites, I've seen more doubt, or at least less conclusive, definitive statements that direction. But they both had dogs, regardless. Now, the Majia Bang do appear to have been better at making pottery. It is less porous and smoother. They also had more variety in terms of size and shapes of their vessels. Not quite as much as the Quahuqiao, but, you know, a decent variety. Also, from what I've seen, I haven't seen that they had any of the black charcoal pottery. They had some kind of whitish, they had light brown, they had red ware. I also didn't see mention of them having the lacquered wood items that the Himadu did. They did use jade and ivory, though. And for most of the pictures I've seen, they didn't really carve quite as distinctive patterns or figures on them. They mostly just used it to shape jewelry and ornaments, though, again, from the pictures I've seen, and, you know, sometimes in these articles, they aren't always very clear in what they're talking about when they say artifacts, but it appears that they have more variety in the shape and sizes of their ornaments of ivory and jade than the Himadu did. I could be wrong about that, though. That is just what I get from looking at the photos of their artifacts and from reading the articles I've read about them. So that could just be me, you know, trying to reinforce my own opinion, or I just could just be misreading things. Now, they did have very similar housing, though I believe the Majia Bang houses tended to be smaller, though there were more of them. So it could be that, you know, they had communal housing. They had so many people, they made their houses slightly smaller, more spread apart, but there were still, you know, more people living in them than what you would expect, you know, from obviously more modern or more compact sites. But another big important reason I think that they were separate cultures is their burial practices. Now, both would bury their dead on their sides, bent facing, you know, they were kind of curled up in their graves, facing towards the east, probably towards the rising sun. Now, this could be just a feature of all people living in the area, possibly, but the Majia Bang didn't bury their dead communally. Instead, they would bury them individually, kind of wherever there was a good spot, kind of on the outskirts of their settlements. Eventually, this changes, and they begin to place them in large communal graveyards. which is something the Himuru do, but they've done it since they appear. And also the Himuru appear to give their dead more grave goods than the Majya Bang. Now, that is just, you know, that's another one of those things. So it is apparent that there is some change. There's more change in the Majya Bang culture than the Himuru do. The Himuru do. No, the Himuru show, I should say. Now, why this happens, I can't say. Again, maybe they are the same people, or at least, you know, they're kind of speaking a similar language to each other. Maybe there's an influx of Himuru people from the south to the north. Maybe the sites at Majya Bang are more prosperous. Maybe it's easier to live there. Who knows? Maybe it's for trade's sake. Maybe it's for, you know, peace. Can't really say one way or the other based on the things I've read. However, the Majya Bang sites, in addition to making these changes, continue to undergo changes. And around 4000 BC, they undergo a big change culturally, at least materially. And this change is so massive that they are then classified as an entirely different material culture. And it replaces the Majya Bang artifacts pretty much universally at their sites overnight. And this new culture is known as the Songzi culture. And they will continue, along with the Himuru, who do not, their sites don't disappear like this. They are continuing the Himuru way of life into next season. And that is where we're going to cover the end of the Himuru and the end of the Songzi, which happens for different reasons. But we will talk about both of them more next season. Because again, they do last, and while I thought about including the Songzi, again, they really show up at the very end. In fact, they may not even show up until like a little bit after this season. So it's possible the Majya Bang are still around, but they're getting ready to undergo some big changes. And we'll cover that more next season. So I hope you will enjoy that. Now, next week, we'll be moving north, and we'll be going along the Yellow River and covering the Neolithic cultures along there. That'll probably be another two-parter, possibly a three-parter. I'm not quite sure yet. I've started to kind of outline stuff, but I really need to kind of go over my sources. There is something I need to talk about, though, in terms of theory. There are thoughts that the Quahuichao or the Himuru or the Majya Bang all may be like early waves of Austronesian people or proto-Austronesian peoples, at least in terms of the language they're speaking, and that, you know, they are kind of a part of this first wave of migration out of that area. Or possibly that they are the proto-Austronesians and then they're going to go to Taiwan and then they'll leave Taiwan and spread out from there. That second theory isn't as widely theorized, or at least widely talked about. Most people think that they might be, well, not most, but a more popular version of that theory is that, yeah, these are people leaving kind of the areas that have been flooded, and that they're trying to find new places to live in addition to Taiwan. No one really has any evidence of that. Those are just theories, and it's all pretty much speculation. But we do obviously have an example that we'll talk about next season where we know that's happening, where there are shared artifacts between Taiwan and the mainland of China. Though, again, that is further south. That's closer to the Pearl River rather than the Yangtze. So, also another reason to keep listening when we get back to this next season. But yeah, so that kind of ties up everything I wanted to talk about this week. Sorry I got tongue-tied in a couple of places. I'm not feeling the best tonight, but regardless, I hope you've enjoyed. I hope you will, like I said, rate, like, subscribe, download, whatever you do on your site of choice. And I hope you'll join me next week, where again, we'll cover some Neolithic cultures along the Yellow River. You guys will be hearing this again a little bit later. I'm finishing up right around my normal time, so that should give me hopefully enough time to add some photos on the YouTube side of things, but we'll see how that process goes. I'm not the best with video editing. I'm going to try, but we'll just see. It is something I need to learn regardless, but thank you all for joining me. If you have any questions, comments, constructive criticism, please feel free to reach out to me at waradrevpod@gmail.com. You can contact me via direct message on X/Twitter, or you can comment on my YouTube videos, where we've had a couple of people talk to me this week, and I do appreciate the feedback I've gotten on YouTube, in addition to emails and direct messages. So, thank you all. I will see you all next time. I hope you have a good rest of your day or week from whenever you're listening to this. See y'all next time. Peace.